Hello, hello, hello. I won't use that one. So that's last time we finished with discussing a little bit memory structure. This time we're going to look a little bit, do a little bit on control structure, which is the where Flynn's classification comes in. And as we've already sort of pointed out, Flynn's classification is sort of trivial in that there really are only two important cases, SIMD and MIMD. In the case of SIMD, every processor is synchronized. We all execute the same instruction stream. MIMD, you have independent instruction streams. And there the synchronization can have several forms. And I thought I did discuss this because I thought I went through the example of message passing acting as a synchronization. But what? That's what I thought. So I pointed out that just the act of sending messages does indeed synchronize programs because something has to send it and the other one has to receive. That act is a natural synchronization point. And for most simple problems, that's all you need for synchronization. We've essentially mentioned the MIMD architecture is best illustrated by a metacomputer. Which is a true distributed memory, but the future of closely coupled systems is MIMD with logically shared memory but physically distributed. And that will be the structure of all of what you might call future machines of this type. And I've already shown you this picture that points out that even on a distributed memory system, you can get at the memory location of any processor, but on something like the SP2, that requires one to send a message to get the memory, location when it is not stored on the current processor. This will be this is a major focus of the current compiler groups to see if we can actually make these hardware assisted distributed memory systems actually work. I think it's not so obvious it will work. Although there is, in fact, it's really unproven that the silicon graphics, and I think silicon graphics, having purchased Cray, will emerge the Cray systems with the silicon graphics system. Silicon graphics has always been shared memory up to now. The Cray MPPs are distributed memory. The expectation is the next system, at least sometime in the modest near future, will be this distributed shared memory system, and whether or not the compilers actually work remains to be seen. The convex has such a system in place. I believe there is some skepticism that the compilers actually work. There is one at NCSA, but they still, I believe, are having, still the software is relatively immature. Well, we've already discussed most of these issues. All the systems now being built, with the exception of the Terra, which I mentioned last time, essentially have a conventional node, which is a conventional microprocessor. Today, they have specialized networks, which are custom built for the particular parallel machine, unless you have a network of workstations where the networking is your choice between Ethernet, FTDI, ATM, or what have you, and you'll find networks of workstations built with essentially every possible standard communication network. And then the last issue is whether that network actually supports direct access to distributed memory. So now we discussed briefly SIMD machines. Best examples are the best known of those in thinking machines, which, as you probably aware, are essentially all obsolete, although I assume a few of them are still being used. There are two small companies, one called AMT and the other called MassPar, and they have essentially withdrawn their machines from being general use. We have two MassPars downstairs. If they aren't switched off, they will be switched off. Both companies are focusing on special purpose applications. MassPar did sell several for image processing problems. The reason for that is that both of the DAP and the MassPar have very high performance two-dimensional mesh interconnects, and so they're particularly good at image processing problems because there are a lot of image processing algorithms which can be run synchronously with the same, with essentially a bunch of pixels, one pixel, if you like, per processor, and then you run the same update algorithm on each pixel. You have a question? So I would say that one of the major reasons that this architecture is of a decreasing interest, that the most obvious thing it does is that it reduces the cost of synchronization because you have the same instruction stream. But the problem with SIMD machines is that the cost of synchronization in MIMD machines is not very high. In particular, that the cost of the memory to store the instruction stream is not very high. Namely, if you take an IBM SP2, which would typically have 256 megabytes of memory on each node or more, that's plenty of memory to store the program. So you can store a separate instruction stream on each processor without actually noticing it. But the fact that memory's got cheaper means it's very easy to have separate instruction streams. It's not a big cost. When we installed our first commercial distributed memory machine when I was at Caltech, that was the NCube 1, that had half a megabyte of memory per processor node. So with half a megabyte of memory per node, then a reasonable fraction of that can be used up by the program. But now, because the cost of memory going down so much, you have a lot more memory per node, and therefore it's a pretty negligible component. Most of that memory can go into data. So the reason why SIMD is used in some of these special purpose applications is that you turn out there are many problems. You do not need a full function floating point unit on each node. Rather, you need some nifty integer unit. And SIMD machines tend to have very simple CPUs where you can very efficiently implement special integer or logical operations. And that you do not need a full function floating point unit. So actually, I think that's on it. So on all the standard SIMD machines, it's like the CM2, the original processor was a 1-bit processor. The first mass power was a 4-bit processor, although the second was a 32-bit processor. And these, in each case, these were actually integer processors, not floating point processors. And you built floating point by just doing it in integer and working out the answer. So by having effectively a lot of very small processors with very densely packed onto a chip, if you had a problem that only needed 8-bit integer arithmetic, you could implement it far more efficiently than using an SP2 with a 64-bit floating point unit, which you happen to only use 8 bits of capability. And so there are these special operations like which are database oriented or signal processing oriented, where you only need special floating point, you know, special processing capabilities. And for those, SIMD machines do have a cost advantage. But even that is a sort of decreasing of interest because the floating point unit in the SP2, say, uses a negligible part of the silicon. And so you can easily add more floating point units or additional capability there. So SIMD are finding it hard to be cost effective. All right, so this file tells us something we mentioned many times, namely, that as well as these, if you like, pure architectures like SIMD or MIMD, you can obviously have mixed architectures where you have a mix of SIMD and MIMD. One good example of that is this room where you could think of the human brain as a SIMD processor, because if you like, the neurons are doing very simple 1-bit arithmetic every 10 to the minus 3 seconds, and so the brain can be thought of as a SIMD system, whereas a collection of people is a MIMD system. So you could view any collection of people as a MIMD collection of SIMD computers. And you could, of course, correspondingly imagine the same thing for digital computers, although as I pointed out, SIMD machines aren't really used very much, so most networks, most heterogeneous or meta computers are actually MIMD collections of MIMD computers or MIMD collections of heterogeneous sequential computers. All right, so this just illustrates that meta computers can have simple structures, which is here a bunch of workstations or a bunch of PCs. So that's a homogeneous. So this really is the obvious workstation implementation of the SP2 or similar parallel machine. Or they could have this heterogeneous structure with a bunch of PCs and workstations, a graphics engine, a database engine, a massively parallel machine like the T3E or the SP2, and maybe a vector machine. So either of those are allowed metacomputers. In principle, the ways you treat these are really quite similar, but obviously this is a lot easier to do in many ways than this. There's just a lot of detail in heterogeneous systems which make them hard, although I think in principle there are not many in principle issues which make the heterogeneous problem different from the homogeneous problem. The complexity of the heterogeneous problem might make it an order of magnitude harder, but I don't think it makes it in principle harder. And then the load balancing is more complex for heterogeneous systems, but the fundamental principles are the same as for homogeneous systems. Same as the issue of message passing versus data parallel, it's much harder for a compiler to generate code for a heterogeneous target machine, but I don't think there's any difference in the basic principles the compiler would use. All right, so let's make a few remarks here about special purpose devices. So many people have built and proposed building a special purpose device. So what they do is they notice that that if you take a given problem, that something that the traditional computer seems to be a big waste on that problem, and so they notice that you can build some sort of customized system to address that problem. So that's been going on for presumably since the history of computing, special purpose devices. And they are especially common in the military for so-called signal processing problems, image processing. I would say that for the reasons I discussed with SIMD machines, that they're actually getting less popular. And the basic reason they're getting less popular is that their cost advantage over general purpose devices is not so great. And the other critical reason is there aren't that many problems where you can do the whole problem with a special purpose device. So let's take an example which I know from my experience a long time ago. I used to do experiments at the Fermilab, which is the accelerator near Chicago. And so when we started we started the first of those experiments, one of the people in the team or one of the groups in the team noted that one of the things we had to do was to find tracks for these high energy particles, which we detected, which is a very compute intense problem. It's essentially an image processing problem, and you could build a special purpose device to do it. The difficulty with that proposal was straightforward, because if you looked at when you actually did the whole problem and you wrote the data on tape and did all the processing of all the different parts of the apparatus, you found the track finding was actually for that problem 5% of the total problem. It was a very small subroutine which could be written in much more effectively with special purpose architectures, but it was only 5% of the problem. So if your special purpose device solves part of a problem, that's only useful if that part of the problem is 95% or more, say, of the whole problem. That, I believe, is one of the difficulties AMT and MassFar will have in the database application. I think for most database applications, the part they do very well, the indexing, looking up indices, actually is a relatively small part of the total problem. And I think this is going to get more and more, there's this difficulty with special purpose devices. It's likely to get more and more serious because people are going to want to address more and more complicated problems. If they address more and more complicated problems, then any one component will get a smaller and smaller fraction. And so it's going to be extremely hard to build effective special purpose devices. So here is actually an example, which there's quite a bit of literature, which is actually a rather old example of a successful special purpose device, in that I think you can justify it for a class of applications. So we actually will study this particular application later on. The machine is called GRAPE, which is for the gravity pipeline machine. It's built by a collaboration between U.S. universities and Japan. And it's meant to solve the so-called M-body problem, namely Newton's laws for a bunch of particles. And if you actually analyze why you can build a special purpose device, the reason is actually that N-body computations have a huge amount of, they don't need much data. I mentioned to you an SP2, a typical SP2 architecture, only spends a few percent of its cost on the microprocessor. The dominant cost of an SP2 is the memory and the memory controller and the I/O and stuff like that. The N-body problem, because each particle interacts with every other particle, and we're building these to solve problems which have around 1 million particles, it says that the amount of work, the amount of computations per data point is about 1 million. Whereas we saw in that Laplace example that for traditional computational fluid dynamics CFD, the amount of work per data point is sort of somewhere between 1 and 100. So M-body problems have a very different ratio of processing performance to memory. So they, if you like, they need 100 times less memory. And so it is possible to build, therefore, a much more cost-effective system for this problem than it is for a more general-purpose application. So let's just say the actual rule of thumb for a typical Laplace or partial differential equation-based problem is that you need about 1 gigabyte of memory per gigaflop performance, or 1 terabyte per teraflop or something. Whereas, I say, that rule of thumb is just totally wrong for M-body problems. It's off a factor of 100. So this machine is likely to be the first machine, for instance, to reach. There is a teraflop version of this machine already built, and it will probably be the first serious petaflop machine built. It should be built in about 5 years. You should be able to get 10 to the 15th operations per second for this application in 3 to 5 years for a relatively modest cost because of its very special structure. But it's worth noticing for the your purposes, if you look at what GRAPE does, it's not using any new algorithm. It will actually use exactly the same parallel algorithm that you will find in this course or in the book we wrote in 1988. So there's nothing special about the algorithm. The algorithm is a classic parallel algorithm. What's different is that each node of the processor got a different ratio of processing to memory. All right. So another an interesting comment on why special purpose devices have not proved so successful is their inflexibility. Namely, we will also discuss, hopefully later in this class, the so-called sparse multiple algorithm, which is the been developed over the last, actually the last 10 years, which uses this nifty idea that if you're doing astrophysics and you want to calculate the force on one star due to a bunch of stars, you can actually replace the bunch of stars by its center of mass and calculate the interaction between the center of mass and that star. And we know intuitively that at least if this is a long way away from here, you do not need to calculate the individual contributions of these stars. You can do the center of mass on its own. And so that's and you can actually make this a very mathematically well-defined algorithm by doing a so-called multipole expansion and truncating the multipole expansion, where the center of mass contribution is just the lowest multiple. So it turns out if you do this algorithm in a particularly nifty fashion and you use it recursively, you take the order n squared algorithm, which is the typical n-body performance, and you replace it by an order n or order n log n algorithm. And this is actually the dominant algorithm used in million particle simulations. So on a million stars, the fast multiple algorithm is about a factor of 100 to 1,000 times faster than the Grafe algorithm. So even if we do get a petaflop performance, it's actually only going to perform at roughly a teraflop rate compared to the fast multiple algorithm on the problems it's going to look at. And there is no way that the great machine can do the fast multiple, because the fast multiple is a traditional low computation rate per data point algorithm and cannot use the special purpose Grafe device at all. So that's the other problem with special purpose devices. If some clever person comes up with a nifty new algorithm, tough luck, because you've just coded the other algorithm in there. And you probably, and in fact in this case, you were able to make great work was because you exploited the simple algorithm. So it still is actually true that for Grafe, we do need, Grafe is a fine machine and should be built, because although the fast multiple algorithm is faster, for globular clusters and some other examples, the fast multiple doesn't work very well, because globular clusters are very heterogeneous. Stars are very close to each other, and if they're very close to each other, you don't gain too much by this nifty algorithm here. So, whereas for more traditional astrophysics, fast multiple algorithm works just perfectly. So there are a few problems for which the n-body, classical n-body, is probably still the best approach. And so they will build great, but for that reason. So the next two or three couple of foils are some remarks on granularity, which is a reasonably useful point. So when you look at a problem, you find you can break it up into parallel parts with so-called different granularities. So when we analyzed Laplace's equation, I would call that a medium grain size, in that the grains could be very large, but you could also make them relatively small. They're relatively closely coupled. And also they need to make them run well, you need a pretty good communication over computation ratio. Now, to give another example, to compare the Laplace's equation with a different example, supposing I was Boeing and wished to design the next generation aircraft. then if I looked at my design problem, it would break up into parts, and I would be able to do the computational fluid dynamics with this so-called, with the algorithm similar to I described in Laplace's equation, which would be median grain size. But I would also be able to take the design problem and notice there's the structural analysis problem to see if the plane stays together. There's the acoustic problem to see how noisy it is. There's a CFD problem for the engine to see if the engine works. There's a CFD problem for the aircraft to see what the drag is, etc. So there's sort of 6 to 10 parts you can break the problem up into. And so that's an example of a coarse grain decomposition. Very large parts. And that's of some interest because the large parts tend to be very suitable for metacomputers because the when there's very big parts, they tend to have much less communications between them, and therefore are quite suitable for network systems where the effective communication is much lower. So. It looks as though I see all of you are looking big blank foils. That's pretty disgusting, isn't it? So I'll complain. I don't know why those foils are blank. They don't look blank here, do they? That's interesting. Have you anybody invented the algorithm which decides whether these foils turn out black? All right, so we'll correct that. All right, so the other type of algorithm are very fine-grained decompositions, where you have, say, huge numbers of very, very small processes. And so, at least intuitively, that's sort of actually the model underlying the SIMD machines, where I pointed out that you might have a one-bit processor, and so that model of a one-bit processor is that it would just control a single pixel, a very small grain size. So if you want to... I mean, computer science has always liked fine-grained algorithms because they're very elegant. Because if you like, you go down to the... I mean, let's go back to Laplace's equation. The finest natural grain from Laplace's equation is a single grid point. Now, if you took a parallel machine and made the basic unit a single grid point, you will find that, I mean, as you've gone through your speed-up analysis, you will notice that a single grid point has a huge communication over compute, I mean, ratio or need. And the only way you can actually get good performance in a parallel machine is to group those grid points together into a relatively large grain, the so-called medium grain size from the previous foil, where actually on a real machine you probably want thousands or tens of thousands of grid points per processor. So fine-grained decompositions, although they're very elegant, because in some sense, if you go back to that Laplace equation, the grid point is the fundamental parallel entity. They're not practical. At least they're very difficult to make them practical because the grid point is very, I mean, a single, the smaller the grain size, the larger the communication ratio that goes with that entity. So I like to remember when I discussed this, when we were doing the Hypercube back in, this is in 81 where it was being designed. So I pointed out that the current IBM SP2 has a quarter of a gigabyte of memory. So when we built this first Cosmic Cube, it had 128 kilobytes of memory. And we carefully worked that out as being that it would work, which it did for the problems at hand. But one of my friends, who was a graduate student of Chuck Seitz at the time, did not like this design because he felt that they had to teach physicists a lesson, and that he recommended reducing the memory to 16 kilobytes per processor so that you would force the application scientists to think from a fundamental point of view and design algorithms with a smaller grain size. Fortunately, we managed to overrule him because it would not have been usable with that amount of memory per node. Whereas it was, and in fact, one of the reasons is if you have too small a memory, this was a MIMD machine, you cannot fit the program in because to actually fit a reasonably interesting scientific simulation into a tiny memory like 16 kilobytes is pretty hard. There's not much complexity of the program you can get into 16 kilobytes. So the rest of this foil comments that the actual machine architecture that people like Daly, who was also another, was a different student of Chuck Seitz, a very talented computer scientist. He built something called the J machine, and Seitz himself built the commercial MirrorNet systems, which are of typical fine-grain processing architecture. This architecture is in fact going to be extremely important, except that it's going to in fact be seen as a medium grain size architecture, because as we've emphasized, as we go towards the year, as we go forward in time, the density of chips is increasing. And so what looks like a fine-grained design 5 years from now will actually have the same amount of memory as a coarse-grained design these days. So when you do these elegant systems like Daly designs with the processor embedded into the memory, which today has a very small amount of memory per processor, in the year 2005, you will have an enormous amount of memory per processor, the same as the typical IBM SP2 today. So all the trends in logic are going against fine-grained architectures because they're tending to make memory, huge amounts of memory, because the logic densities are going to be such that you will have in the supercomputer in the year 2007 is bound to have something like 10 to 20 terabytes of memory. And you can't divide that up into, so you're bound to get quite a lot of memory per processor. Naturally, gigabytes of memory, and if you really try hard, you might reduce that to a smaller amount, maybe even megabytes of memory per processor, but still megabytes, and megabytes is quite a lot of memory. You can put quite a lot of program and quite a lot of data points in megabytes of memory. So what that says is that the sort of issues in computer architecture are somewhat mixed up with the changes in the chip density. So this is an example. This is a load of rubbish. Isn't this a load of rubbish? They only produced every other page, is that right? 39, 40. Yeah, we're going to have to replace this. Look at this. 35, 30. Well, that's it. So my belief is these are going to have to be replaced. They look garbage to me. So I hope you have a good friend in your recycling department. There's clearly some mistakes in this copy. I apologize. Alright. Let me just... All right, so the there are several classes. In detail, there are an enormous amount of of network architectures, two important subclasses are switches. Here is a typical multi-stage switch allowing four processors to talk to four memories or four other processors. And probably the most important architecture is the one that's seen in the most real processors is the bus architecture, which is, if you like, also the Ethernet architecture, where you have a single communication channel which you hang all your devices. So these are so the reason why buses are very popular, of course, is that they produce a rather elegant machine, which are relatively easy to build. The memory access is fairly uniform because all machines are hanging off the same bus. These machines can either be uniform memory access, but are more typically non-uniform memory access because you have a bunch of processor. Each processor has its own memory, so it will have one speed to its own memory, and then another speed when it goes through the bus to a different processor's memory. The fundamental problem with a bus is that it runs you cannot build a bus with more than, say, 16 to 32 processors. So if you look at Silicon Graphics, they will offer you a power challenge, and I think the power challenge basically doesn't work after about 16 processors on most applications. So it's wonderful up to some, depending on the performance of the node. The power challenge has such a powerful node, it really only goes well up to 16 processors. Somewhat lower speed nodes will go up to more like 32 processors. So it's the problem with that design is not scalable. You cannot build that design in a way that you can increase the number of processors, for the trivial reason that they're sharing the communication channel. So if you double the number of processors, you halve the bandwidth. So a switch is a much more scalable architecture because most switches, well, all switches can essentially be scaled. Some scale better than others. And so that the switching network is the one used in things like the SP2, the Paragon, and the T3DNE, because that's a scalable architecture, which is rather straightforward to build up to thousands of processors on a switch with reasonably good performance. This probably isn't even in your folder. Yep. Who knows what? I don't know what happened here. I mean, it doesn't make sense that both foils turn out black and foils are missing. It seems as though something crazy happened. All right, so I say when at least I started back in 81, there was great interest in the so-called topology, which was how you connected your nodes together, which is either the... So here are four topologies: two-dimensional grid, a binary tree, a complete interconnect, and here's a hypercube, in this case in four dimensions. You can either think of these green things as processors or nodes in a switch. And as I think I mentioned earlier in the class, there used to be a great deal of interest in these various architectures. And it is true that some architectures are better than others, but today they really aren't terribly important. because people only build architectures that are sensible and work, and there isn't a bigger difference between the good architectures. The difference between the architectures is not the topology, this versus this, but rather how well you actually implement the hardware and software. What is the latency of the message passing system and things like that. So with today's technology, the difference in these topologies, well, the difference between the good topologies versus these two is not important. These are bad topologies because for a binary tree, for this node to talk to that node, it's got to wander up to the top of the tree and then down again. So that's a very bad architecture, although for the CM5 you have a so-called factory which makes this device okay because it this is a bottleneck in the simple design, but if you make the communication bandwidth higher at the top of the tree, then it turns out there isn't a bottleneck, so it works okay. And a factory looks very like a hypercube. The complete interconnect is a fine design, except that it's impractical, as you see from this diagram. If you had 1,000 nodes, and you connected 1,000 nodes to each other, that's 1,000 times 999 over 2 interconnects, which you'd have to build. So that says that for n processors, you need n squared interconnects. That's not scaling. For this device, for this type of network, you have n processors and n links, so that scales. These two, you have n processors and n log n links, that effectively scales. And so essentially scaling, namely up to logarithms. And log of the types of numbers we're building these days and will build for the next foreseeable future is not a very big number. So there are a lot of very reasonable switches that you can build or topologies, and they all essentially work. And for the user, whether that user is an application user or a compiler writer or a message passing writer, the switch doesn't matter because the low-level operating system will ensure that the details of switches are hidden from you. It will provide the functionality that allows one processor to talk to another processor just by addressing that processor without worrying about the interconnect between them. Just as when you have a memory system, you can go and grab a location from that memory without knowing the details of the memory architecture. The memory architecture, whether it's cached or not, or paged or not, hides the details of the of its. I mean, all you care about is that you go to a location and get it. The hardware and operating system hide details from you. The same is true with parallel architectures. All the details of the message passing and the topologies are just hidden from you. To show you that diagram, did it? So we'll come back to this one. We'll go to this one. All right. So there are various useful concepts. We've already essentially mentioned the importance of scalability. Fault tolerance is meant to be important, and obviously it is, except that it has not had a big impact on designs up to now. Namely, some machines are more fault tolerant than others, but I don't believe there's a lot of difference between designs in terms of fault tolerance. The communication systems need to be blocking so that you can in fact fail to get through, or they can be non-blocking so that communication requests at a performance cost actually always succeed. Two critical parameters we have essentially mentioned already are latency and bandwidth. And then a lot of the current switches use so-called wormhole routing, which basically mean you take this long message and break it up into little bits, and you just let the little packets through. And so the message is essentially a long string of packets worming its way through the network, and the first part of the worm does not wait for the next part of the worm. It just roars on through if it can. Alright, so here are some typical numbers of from communication performance. So these are the at least as of probably 1995, the peak communication performance this is effectively what we call TCOM, or well, it's the communication speed, so it's 1 over TCOM. And this is the computation speed, which is the 1 over the floating, I mean it's 1 over T float, the floating point performance. So that says for the IBM SP2 you can get 40 megabytes per second into each node. Notice a byte is, a floating point word is at least 4 bytes, it could be 4 or 8 bytes. So that says the SP2 can pump 10 million floating point words over the communication channel every second into the node. So 40 divided by 4 gives 10, so 10 mega words per second. In that time, it in principle can do 267 million floating point operations. So that says that for the SP2, it can do 27 floating point operations for every 32-bit floating point word it communicates. And so this gives you the numbers for the various other machines, an old Intel machine, the latest Intel machine, the defunct Kendall Square full cache machine, the Mako machine, which was delivered to Livermore. These are two European systems, Mako and Partitech, CM5 and the Cray T3D. Nobody, and very few people, of course, these are all the standard, what are often called guaranteed not to exceed numbers. And often you get far, especially like on the CM5, nobody ever gets 128 megaflops per node. You were lucky to get a tenth of that. On the SP2, you can get probably hundreds of megaflops per node if you're lucky, but probably more like 30 to 50. You study that diagram in great detail, it will tell you what it says. Oh no. That's warming up. Maybe somebody could turn the light off in the back there. Alright. Alright, so if you take those numbers on the previous foil, the maximum floating point performance and maximum communication speed. This tells you what this parameter that we used in the plastics example is for these machines, namely. So they vary, as we say, from 27 for the IBM SP2. The Intel Paragon has a lousy chip, the i860, but an excellent communications network. And so actually, if you look at these numbers, they sort of, I think you'd say that they vary between 10 and 20 would be a good ballpark number, 10 to 30 maybe, for TCOM over TFLOP, because obviously there are outliers which either have lousy networks, well, you could say these two have bad, so maybe 10 to 20. This has an lousy processor. These, if you like, have lousy networks. So, so let's see if it deigns to. I have no idea what's happened to those files, but anyway, we have these ones instead. Right, so this picture here is meant to show the issues, the discussion of the latency and the bandwidth of a network. So when we transmit information from one processor to another, you start the data off somewhere, it goes through a bunch of switch nodes, and then it ends up somewhere else at another processor. And there's a sort of pipelining of the data as it goes from one processor to another. So if you look at what the transmission time is, the once you get it started, the data is just going to flow. So there's going to be some startup time, which is the time from the user to wake up, and the user decides to wake up the system and start the data here, till the first data point gets over to the final processor and lands up in the user buffer there. So that's the latency. The latency is the end-to-end time of the first bit getting from the initial processor to the final processor. And then after that, the data is just going to flow at a uniform rate, and so the total transmission time is a constant, which is called the latency, plus the some another constant just times the number of bits or the number of bytes transmitted. And so this thing is the inverse of the bandwidth. And the startup time involves two components. One, if you like, is the amount of time it spends actually running over the wires and through the switches here. And the other time is the startup time here and the processing time here. So for most systems, the latency is dominated by here and here and doesn't have much to do with what goes on in the middle. And so the next foil, which doesn't. Is this one shown on your? Do you have a version? All right, so good, you can see it. So this is a very typical. These are typical curves. So this shows a transfer time against message size. The message size here is 1 million bytes, and here is a message size essentially of 1 byte. And you see here the message time is essentially flat. That says that if the time is T0 plus T1 times the number of bytes, here we're dominated by the T0 term because you don't see any byte dependence. Up here it's linear because you're just seeing the T1 times the number of bytes term. This is logarithmic here. And here's the transition time. So so you can see that for most of these systems, which the transition time between the linear and the constant domain is somewhere between 100 and 1,000 bytes, which in words is between 25 and 250 words. So around 100 words. So that says the typical startup time for these systems is about 100 words. So, and of course that's why that in compiler technology it's extremely important to group messages together. You want to get them in this, you want to get your message traffic to be in this part of the domain, the linear part of the domain, because it's in the linear part of the domain where you're going to get the best performance. Because if you choose to send 100 messages of, let's take this example here where we have 100. So if we did 100 messages each of 100 bytes, that would take a total of 10 to the fourth microseconds. Alternatively, we sent one message of 10,000 bytes and came up here. It's about a factor of 5 smaller. So you want to get out of the domain where your startup time dominated, because that's obviously going to have huge overheads attached to it. So it's extremely important to design your algorithms so that you have large messages. And so that's one of the major goals of compilers. And reason is very hard. And it's typically extremely hard because of these comments I made with fine grain and coarse grain. If you look at most problems, the natural granularity of parallelism is something like a grid point. If you look at a grid point, the natural amount of communication is 4, well, small number. And so the natural unit of parallelism in nearly all problems has a very bad ratio of is always in the latency-dominated regime. So it's extremely important to group grid points together to make these medium grain size objects. And that's what compilers or users have to do. You must not write your program. The world's simplest program, and if you read all these nifty papers on fine-grained machines, they'll always write these very beautiful programs with the very fundamental elements as the things, you know, that are the objects. And those are the prettiest programs. The trouble about those pretty programs is they have lousy performance. And so you have to do this relatively ugly thing of gluing lots of grid points or lots of fundamental entities together, because then you get this edge over area effect, which has two advantages. You reduce the amount of communication, and also you increase the size of messages, because the natural size of a message in that Laplace example was root n. If I have n points in a node, the natural thing to do was to send a single message, which was the row, which was all the points stored in one processor needed by another processor. So that was the square root of the grain size in such a problem. So that says if the grain size gets bigger, the natural size of the message also gets bigger. So it's essential, therefore, for two reasons, to decrease the needed bandwidth and to decrease the latency, to have as large, to have large grain size and not use this elegant, natural form of parallelism. And so, if you like, one of the goals of data parallel programming is to write algorithms which address these fundamental entities, which are the grid points, or be it arrays of grid points, but to let the compiler group those grid points together into the optimal size so that you get these good performance. So this is another figure from this paper by Dungara and Dunnigan, and it actually has somewhat more points on it. And here you have the bandwidth measured in megabytes per second. Remember, here's the SP2 at 40 megabytes per second. Here's the Paragon at, here it's got it at 171 megabytes per second. And here's the latency, so for the SP2 it's around 40 microseconds, and so this plots these various parameters against each other. What you want to be is here, low latency, high bandwidth. So that, for instance, you notice the Cray T3D is substantially better than the SP2. That's well known. The Cray has got much better communication network. It's a somewhat more modern machine, actually. The Paragon actually has better bandwidth but poorer latency than the Cray T3D. That's because the Cray T3D has a special primitive. It's essentially got a distributed shared memory architecture. It has a special, well, not a full one, but it has a special primitive called GET, which goes and gets a single memory location from another processor. So that's what they mean by shared memory, because that's a shared memory implementation of the T3D. And here's actually the T3D in its distributed shared memory mode without using the special shared memory hardware, which you see is rather similar to the SP2. So if you like, these square points here illustrate, and this here is the convex, which also has distributed shared memory hardware. This is the advantage of the distributed shared memory hardware. It reduces the latency for accessing data in a different processor. It doesn't change the bandwidth enormously. The most important thing it does is reduce the latency, and it sort of has to do that to be useful. Because if we're going to allow users to access memory as though it's memory, they're not going to group things together into big big messages. They're going to just go and get A of I, which is going to be a few bytes. So the distributed shared memory programming model implies small messages as the natural unit of information. And so it's essential to have good hardware support for that. Here we have an Ethernet connected system. But notice these latencies are quite big. So these are 10 microseconds. In 10 microseconds you can do thousands of floating point operations. IBM SP2, 267 floating point operations per microsecond. It's sitting here at 40 or 50 microseconds latency. So that says it can do 10,000 floating point operations in the time it starts to send a zero length message. So that emphasizes how important it is, how dangerous communication is. All right, that's a reasonable place to stop. That's basically the end of this discussion, a short discussion of hardware. Next time we'll start, I think I will not discuss applications. I'm going to start software next week. I haven't quite decided whether I'm going to do high performance Fortran or MPI first. I'm not certain. Well, that says that, that's why I classify granularities. That says that you're only going to do meta-computing with large grain size. The question is whether it's very large or mediumly large. You're not going to do meta-computing and access single memory locations. So that says that meta-computing only works with very large grains. Now the thing that's in your favor is that the following, that problems are very big. I mean, there are millions of grid points or millions of particles. So there is a pretty, application programs have naturally very large grain sizes. So the only trouble is you've got to have a programming model which supports easily the production of large grain size programs. So there's a standard folklore that Pratt and Whitney use their network of RS6000s to do engine simulation. They do that overnight. So, and the reason they can afford to use just ordinary network workstations is they're actually using classic data parallel algorithms with dividing the domain up into paths and putting one part in each processor. And it works because they have a huge number of grid points. So as long as you have a big enough problem, this will work. Now, if you wish to run a million machines, each with one grid point, you'll see mammoth slowdown. You will get a speed up of less than one on the World Wide Web. But it is quite practical even but that's not the problem you want to solve. You don't want to solve that problem on a World Wide Meta computer. So you just, one of the reasons we go through this analysis is to say that you can actually lead to the wrong conclusion if you use the wrong method. I mean, what you're going to do is to look at the problem, find out what is natural level of parallelism, and look at the machine, see what its parameters are, and match the problem to the machine. And if you don't do that, if you run irrelevantly small problems on a powerful machine, you get lousy performance, but that's what you're meant to get, lousy performance. So it's extremely important to choose good problems to solve which are suitable for the machine. It's also true when you write a computer science thesis addressing some fundamental issue, you better decide it's an important issue and it's an issue that people care about, because there are some problems which just don't exist because people would never want to solve them. So these principles are very, very trivial. They're very straightforward. I mean, there's latency, there's bandwidth, there's grain size, and the relationship between them is really rather obvious. And you get roughly the right intuition from that Laplace example. You will, although most problems are more complicated, apart from different numerical coefficients, essentially all problems have that general structure. And so you're going to get the good intuition by looking at those, looking at that problem. But don't write a paper solving the wrong problem, like 100 by 100 the plus on a 256 node SP2. You'll reach conclusions about your compiler or whatever you're testing, which are just irrelevant, because it will have an irrelevantly small grain size. Okay.